Our subject this morning is Kriya Yoga, the science of increasing your, or speeding up your spiritual evolution. When we think of progress in a worldly sense, we think in terms of effort, of reaching out from here to there. What do we mean when we speak of spiritual progress? It's essential that we understand that if we are to understand how Kriya Yoga helps us. To progress from one place to another is to imply, of course, that we aren't there until we get there. We're spiritual progress. We're there all the time. We've never been anywhere else. There's nowhere else for us to go. In ordinary worldly effort to acquire or accomplish anything, you have to build up a body of knowledge, a body of skills, equipment that you need in order to accomplish a task, whatever it might be. It's always sort of an acquisition, an accumulation. And so it is that people think that when they advance spiritually, it's the same idea, that I've got to love everybody. It's hard enough just to love one person. They think that this build-up of energy that you have to keep putting out, this build-up of knowledge that you have to acquire to remember all these things in order to understand the ways of God, it all seems impossibly heroic. The book on Hinduism, it's called, you've probably seen it in bookstores, it's by a French author, Louis Renault, says that yogis aspire by a paroxysm of tension, is the way he puts it, to enter a state which they call samadhi. And this is a perfectly natural conclusion to draw when you study the idea of ecstasy, that it be a process of building up so much tension that you go into some sort of a dizzy state and assume that this is ecstasy. The very word ecstasy means to stand outside of, and it's the idea ecstasis. Stasis is to stand, and the idea is that you build up so much of this pressure inside that you sort of pop out of your skin. And in one way or another, people actually, probably everybody, has some of that lingering thought in his mind, even after he comes onto the path, of the strain involved in being a saint, the strain involved in being in a state of ecstasy. There's this thought when you first feel joy in meditation, of this build up of, oh, can I really take it? And you tend at first to get tense. It's because everything that we do in the world requires that kind of tension. This is why Master taught us the energization exercises. Two reasons. The one we all know, but the other most people don't take into account. The one is that you energize, Master said, tense with will. But then he said, relax and feel. We need to understand both sides of the energy. The one is sending the energy to the body, having enough control over the energy to be able to direct it at will to the different parts of the body. And the second is to be able to relax it and feel the inner side of that tension, the withdrawal of that energy from the body. Now, spiritual progress involves basically the second aspect. It in fact involves both, for two reasons. One is that unless you can gain some kind of control over your life outwardly, you'll never be able to control it and go within. The second is that it's allied to the first, and that is that you need, for example, if you've got a horse that's out of control, running out of control, you can't just pull on the reins and make the horse stop. Still less can you get off the horse. You have to go with it and let it gradually exhaust itself or gradually exert influence on the horse until it begins to feel that you are the master, and then slowly it will begin to respond to your commands again. And so it is that in our search for the inner life, we need to be able to go with the energies which are out of control, the energies that go toward desire, toward involvement, toward delusion, and going with them, bring them gradually under control so that we can turn them within. In this case, for example, when we do the energization exercises, we become aware that it's energy that is controlling the tension in the muscles that enables us to do what we want to do. And if we concentrate on that cause of our strength, cause of tension, then we'll be able to tense as we want to, rather than, for example, as many people are, tensed without even wanting to be tense. Tense because they're out of control. They're just always uptight, literally. And so, by learning how to send the energy, learning that it is energy that causes that tension, learning control over the energy so that you can withdraw the energy, that is an important aspect of the path, in the sense that we learn to guide our actions wisely and with conscience, the consciousness. That's the idea also of karma yoga, that we have done many things in the past that are antipathetic to our spiritual ambitions, our spiritual progress. And if we are to advance spiritually, we can't just put those in a corner and forget them, because they're always there tugging our consciousness down. But we can offset them. For example, an example I've often used, that if you have the desire to accumulate for yourself, then accumulate, but for others. Buy things to give to them. If you have the desire to hurt, then put energy out to heal. It's energy going out toward people, affecting their lives, but in a way that will help them. If you have had a desire for power, then to use that desire in a way to serve, rather than merely boss, is a way of gradually converting that karma from bad karma to good karma, after which you'll be able, it's like putting weights onto the positive side of a scale until finally it tips, and then all that energy can be guided in the direction that you want. So in that way, we learn to gain control over the energy, to direct the energies we want to, and so on. But spiritual progress, in fact, is the opposite side of that particular flow. It's not the sending of the energy out, except as a means of getting control over that energy that's going out anyway, so that you can turn it around and turn it inward. Spiritual progress begins with the inward flow of that energy. And so let's go into it more deeply to understand what spiritual progress really means. The Spirit, God, when it manifested everything outward from its own self, it progressed outward into varying degrees. Well, let's use an example of a light. The power of an electric light diminishes, of course, with distance. Everything diminishes in power with distance, with the interesting exception of human thought. The power of telepathy apparently doesn't, but energy does. Why does it diminish with distance? Well, partly because it's always radiating outward, so that when you're here, you're getting a full force of it. But when you're here, you're getting only a part of the ray that is going out, because it's going out in all directions. And the further away you get, the more diminished that particular ray is. That would be a part of the explanation, at least. So it is that the Spirit, from the center, as Master has said, center everywhere, circumference nowhere, the Spirit manifests its power in creation. And the farther it manifests outward from that central blazing light, the more that power of light becomes diminished. And in that diminution, it begins to take on lower and lower aspects of what was actually first thought, consciousness, but then became energy. In this sense, it is diminishing, but I'm not going to go into that side of it. It's too trivial to our cause right now. The energy going out further and further gradually takes on its lowest manifestation of solid matter. And what we can do, and this is how they've explained it in the Indian scriptures, is that as this energy, as this divine consciousness manifests itself in nature, it takes on koshas or sheaths. We can possibly put it this way too. I'm being a bit technical in the philosophy of India. It will help you to understand in a deeper sense, and I think it's worth doing. The way that all things are created is by, as it says in the Bhagavad Gita, an admixture of three qualities: tamo, rajo, and sattva. Sattva is the positive pole. Tamo is the negative pole. Rajo is the neutralizing between the two. The positive pole is that which draws back into the spirit. The negative pole is that energy from that force coming out from God, pushing everything into manifestation. And it's an actual force that has to be put out in order to bring things into creation. It's the negative pole, and its pull is toward the opposite of everything that spirit is. Its pull is away from consciousness, away from light, away from love, away from wisdom, away from calmness, everything down into darkening consciousness, lack of consciousness, inertia, all that is opposite. In between, we have that which takes on both qualities. It's merely sort of energy going in circles. Now, as this energy goes out, everything is an admixture of it. Yogananda used the illustration of the wave on the ocean, that every wave has three parts: that part which is the crest, that part which is in the middle, and that part which is right, just closest to the bosom of the ocean. And in a very tall wave, you see the crest mostly. In a very low wave, what you see is the low base and hardly any crest at all. It would almost be difficult to see where the crest is. Similarly, with the creation of everything, you have that which is farthest away from its own center, its own spiritual reality, that which is closest, and that which is sort of in between, tending in both directions or either direction. Egotistical people who are very worldly, who are very full of desires, have a very tall crest of ego, that part of the consciousness which pushes away from its own center and wants to get involved in conquest and competition and ownership and power and so on. And that which is closest to the spirit is that aspect which even the greatest egotist has of longing for its own true nature. Now, as creation is manifested outward, it manifests more and more in the negative direction. Just as when a wave on the bosom of the ocean gets tall, you see more and more and more of that crest until finally it can't stand its own height and starts to crash, and you get the white caps, or you have a storm, the waves crash together, and thus the egotistical people will be constantly in conflict with one another. I was reading a book the other day. It described the slave trade in Africa. And I just couldn't imagine the treatment that people meted out to one another. It wasn't just the white people treating the blacks this way. It was the blacks treating themselves this way. A man in Africa would cheerfully sell his own sister or brother into slavery for a necklace of beads. And it was just terrible the way people treated each other. An Arab dhow coming into port had to pay tax on the slaves that it brought in, and so it would throw overboard any that weren't really fit to sell anyway, that would probably die, and the sharks would get them. And this is just a minor part of the kind of things that was meted out to millions of people. We've seen the terrible things that man has done to man in this century. It's hard to believe, and yet it's a simple fact. How is it possible for people to be so dark, so evil? It's because their waves have become so tall, their waves of ego. They're so far away from what they really are, so far away from understanding what they really are, that they're incapable. For example, one sultan's great pleasure in life was killing people by knotting tying a knot around their heads and then squeezing it tighter and tighter and tighter until the eyes popped out and finally the skull cracked inward. No, that was great fun. And there were many of the tribes in Africa would have great fun. Their greatest fun was spearing women and children. And lots of fun, you know. It's just hard to believe, isn't it? Because when you get onto the spiritual path and you start to feel the touch of divine love and the ego starts to diminish, you realize that other people's suffering is your suffering. You're down lower and closer to the bosom of the ocean, and you can see the connection between your wave and other waves. And you can realize that the water that's in your wave is also in them, and their pain is your pain. But in Iran just recently, when they had their big uprising and took over, they were torturing prisoners and playing their screams over a loudspeaker so all the crowd could listen and enjoy it. And they were thoroughly enjoying it. What kind of joy, huh? Well, mankind is capable of becoming a monster or becoming a saint. And no nation and no race, no people and no religion has been immune from the worst or bereft of the best. We find great souls in all cultures and we find monsters in all cultures. What we have to understand is what it really means and why it happens, how it's possible. When God manifested himself into creation, that energy, that consciousness, that power went out from this source more and more into darkness, into nescience, until finally it became locked in what appears to us as inanimate matter. There was first this wave of creation going out, and then was introduced into that the pull, the call of divine love, Krishna in the forest, playing his flute and calling to all creation to come back. This is the call of nature, of our true nature upon our false nature, our outward nature. And this process, the divine pull, gradually awakens matter. So that in the evolution of a planet, first you have the molten rocks becoming formed and mountains and the great upheavals and cataclysms as the mountains and continents and oceans are formed. And then gradually comes life. What causes this life? It's basically that divine pull on all atoms to come back to their own center, to their own source. And as that happens, the outward sheath begins to be shed. The sheath of sheer darkness, blindness, unconsciousness. And you have the vegetable kingdom, where the sheath behind that is the sheath of action. And so there's a starting of movement. The plants are able to sort of wave their tendrils and turn their blossoms and leaves toward the sunlight. And they breathe, and there's a little bit of consciousness there. We are aware now, because of experiments that have been done on plants, that they have consciousness. It doesn't mean you could sit down and play a game of chess with a plant, but nevertheless it does respond to vibrations of love and so on. They've experimented sending love to a plant and hatred to another, and the one that they sent hatred to died, and the one that they sent love to flourished. Jyotish and Devi went back to Minneapolis, and they went to a concert out of doors, and people brought their plants to the concert because they'd read that plants like music, symphony music. And one of them said, well, he's very shy. He isn't. This is the first time he's been out of doors. So, but actually there is some consciousness, but mainly they're able to start moving. And then as that energy keeps drawing a little bit further back and that sheath becomes open, then the sheath behind that begins to manifest itself. And that's the sheath where the senses begin to perceive. And the plants are also not only vaguely conscious, but vaguely able to perceive. They're able to see the sunlight, for example, to sense where it's dark and where it's light. But they don't have eyes. They can't see through senses that can help them to perceive as clearly as the animals can. As that sheath begins to open up, as the divine force begins to act upon them and to withdraw a little bit further, then that sheath of just movement begins to open to the senses, and the senses begin to operate, and you have the development of the animal kingdom. And then gradually, as the animal, as the energy operates upon the animal kingdom, you have the inner sheath behind that, which is the sheath of intelligence, and mankind, the rational animal, is evolved. And this happens all over the universe. It just doesn't just happen on this one planet. This is the path of evolution as matter evolves gradually back toward that which is its only reality, God. And mankind, with his intelligence, is able to interact with the world, to manipulate the world according to his own desires, to do what he wants to, and with his intelligence to be able to further his own interests or do good or whatever it is. But bit by bit, as man evolves, the intelligence begins to not withdraw, to open up toward the further manifestation of the heart. The heart's natural love begins to unfold, and with that love, then spiritual progress is really possible. The heart, as it unfolds, begins, it first of all is attached to things, but bit by bit it begins to understand that its own true source is at its center in God. And thus, bit by bit, everything evolves back through love into union with that which it most truly longs for, which is the divine. Up to the human level, progress is automatic. Man alone has the intelligence to be able to even conceive of the reality of progress. He doesn't think until he reaches the human level, a being doesn't think in terms of progress. It merely thinks in terms of coping, you might say, just getting along, eating, sleeping, defending itself, whatever. And so, how does that progress happen if there isn't intelligence? It happens in a way that's very important and very pertinent to the whole point of Kriya Yoga. It happens by a process of magnetizing. In the evolution of this planet, we find that the movement of the other planets around it help to magnetize. They don't move around the Earth literally, but they move in such a way, with our turning and their going around the sun, as to appear to move around this Earth. And that movement that comes both from our turning and from the general movement of energy in the solar system, this gradually, like a generator, helps to bring energy, magnetism, into this world. There's another aspect, and this is all a part of what Sri Yukteswar's book, The Holy Science, is about. And he said that our planet is, our whole solar system is going around the dual of our sun, which has never been discovered by astronomers. But an interesting thing about what Sri Yukteswar wrote is that everything else that he wrote was written at a time when science couldn't have defended any of it, and yet has been corroborated. First, that matter's underlying nature is energy. He wrote this back in the last century when scientists would have been prepared to scoff at that. It wasn't until Einstein that it was discovered that, in fact, the basic reality of matter is energy, that matter is energy. And he said that we are at the present time moving toward the center of our galaxy. And at that time, astronomers didn't know where the center of our galaxy was and didn't know in which direction we were moving and didn't know where we were in relation to that center. But all of these things have been proved to be valid. And quite recently, astronomers began to postulate, this came out in Newsweek, I read it just a few months ago, began to postulate that we might indeed have a dual, that another star, a dual to this one, would explain erratic movements in the outer planets that could possibly be explained by another planet, but would be explained better if there were another star, something, a much larger body further out. And because they haven't seen it, they postulate that it may be a dark star, which they know exists also. Well, the interesting thing is that's the last piece of the claims that Sri Yukteswar made, all the others of which have already been justified. When he talked of the objective nature of the universe and where we are in relation to it and so on. What he said was that as our solar system goes toward, by rotating around its dual, goes toward the center of the galaxy, there's a tremendous power coming out from that center, tremendous spiritual energy, and in that process, all beings and mankind too is gradually awakened. So there we need to touch on a point. We can use an illustration, which is an observation that we can all make. If you observe somebody who is in a human way enlightened, I'm not speaking of masters and saints, many of you will never have met them perhaps, but I'm talking of people, just ordinary people, those who seem to be more enlightened and those who are evidently less enlightened, those who are geniuses and those who are morons, those who are very competent and capable of doing what they're doing, and those who somehow bumble their way to failure in everything that they do. The basic difference isn't necessarily intelligence. You'll sometimes find people who are very intelligent, but somehow they fumble everything. One man who had an IQ of 160 was doing nothing but mending watches. And it isn't only intelligence as we've defined it. Don't forget that the IQ tests were invented by a particular breed of people who will try to make the claim that the standard of intelligence must be measured according to what they are. But they aren't the ones, necessarily, who are able to do the great things that have been done by mankind. It would be far better if the great geniuses got together and decided what is an intelligence quotient. So, in any case, for example, you find that some people who don't seem to do very well at IQ tests are brilliant. They just don't care. It doesn't matter to them whether you have to put these little square holes into round pegs or whatever it might be. It just... So, the basic difference that we see in these people, who are more enlightened in the normal human way of thinking, is that they are people of great energy. And it's that energy that seems to enlighten their intelligence. And how they use that intelligence is going to vary with different people. A person who may, to let us say somebody who's been reading Kant and Hegel and Schopenhauer and Aeschylus and Aristotle and all the various prophets and is very up on all the culture of the West, and he meets somebody who's come up from the slums and hasn't read any of that junk and couldn't care less about it, and he'll think, what a fool. And yet that man may be far more brilliant than he. It's that he's taken his intelligence and directed it in a different way. So we're talking of that essence rather than the manifestation of that essence. The essence of it is energy. When there's tremendous energy, you'll find that people have what it takes to accomplish whatever they want to do. And people with little energy, they may seem very intelligent, but somehow they never get their butts off the ground to do anything. And energy is always the real key. You'll see that if there's somebody who has a tremendous amount of energy, he's the one. I've seen some people who didn't seem to have any spirituality at all, but they had tremendous energy. And once they got onto the spiritual path, they really blazed a trail. And I've seen other people who seemed so spiritual, they were always good, and they always helped little old ladies across the street, and they come onto the path and they don't get anywhere. Because they haven't energy. They sit there and meditate and they try to do good things, but it's always sort of in a pepless flow. That's why I get impatient with people who just say, oh, it's all Ram. And one time, not to make you squirm, Nirmala, but Nirmala read that passage in the path where Master was talking about founding communities, and she was quoting him as saying, and you must go north, south, east, west, everywhere. I said, give me that book. The way he spoke it was with such power. Some people think, well, they're always astounded when they hear his voice on a recording because he spoke with so much power, and they always expect this sort of sweet little nursery rhyme or something to come out. And John Ball yesterday asked me, well, did he always talk like that? And I said, well, yes. Not always in the sense that he always talked loudly and shouted. Sometimes he talked very sweetly, of course. But it was always with power. You always felt this tremendous reserve of energy. As he used to say back in the Depression days when many people were out of work, he said, if I needed a job, I would shake the world until it had to give me one. And that was the kind of attitude that he had. I remember when we had this, some of our members started a company. It wasn't an Ananda company, but it was something I didn't want them to fail in, since they'd put their hearts into it. And so when they were on the brink of failure, I invited them to my house and asked them to just discuss if there was any way that we could improve on the thing. It wasn't that we needed to do it, but it was for their sake. And so I tried to shake them and give them some ideas. All they got out of it was that I was laying down the law and feeling threatened. Here their jobs were going down the drain, and they'd rather let that happen than get a little energy behind what they're doing. Well, that's typical of a lot of people, unfortunately. What you will find is that those people who succeed in life are those who have the energy to do what they have to do, and a great deal more energy. Most people will put out, they'll think, well, is this how much energy I need to put out to succeed? All right, I'll put out this much. And the success never goes to those people. It goes to those people who say, is this how much I need? Then I'll put out twice as much. Why? Well, because it's always twice as much anyway that you need. It's always, there are always going to come obstacles and so on. You've got to have that kind of determination where you simply couldn't imagine giving up. That if this won't work, and if 1,000 things don't work, it doesn't matter, I'll just keep going. Well, anyway, to come back to what I was saying, it is energy, the degree of energy, that determines the degree of awakeness. And as these sheaths, this is the negative side of it, the removal of the sheaths, but the positive side of it is the flow of energy that simply sort of sheds those sheaths, the magnetizing of that flow of energy from the negative, the tamas, the tamoguna, to the positive, or sattvaguna. And as that flow of energy becomes stronger, so gradually that the sheaths are removed, and more the true inner light, the true inner nature of the entity becomes revealed. Now, some of what I'm saying is a little deep, but if you're going to come to a weekend on Kriya Yoga, then you might as well be prepared for some of that sort of thing. In the beginning, this process is accomplished by the normal magnetizing flow. It's the normal influence of the divine on the heart of all things, sort of slowly reminding them of their own true nature, making them want to become more conscious, making them just like the plant. It isn't very conscious, but it's got a little bit of consciousness that makes it want to, that makes it react to things. It finds that some things it likes, some things it doesn't like that. That marvelous experiment that they did with plants in a box. They put a loudspeaker next to it, and then they played different kinds of music through the loudspeaker to see which kinds of music the plant would like. They played rock music, and the plant started sending out tendrils in the opposite side of the box, trying to crawl out of its box. And then they played classical music, and the plant started sending tendrils around the loudspeaker to embrace it. You see, there's a certain amount of, in the very instinctual reaction of the lower forms of life, there is a certain amount of likes and dislikes. And in that very process of liking something, there's a movement toward that which is harmonious, a movement toward that which is more light, less darkness, a movement toward that which gives more energy, because there's more fun when you have more energy, and you feel sort of down when there's less energy, there's less life. And all things want life, and they don't want merely existence. They want to enjoy their life. The survival of the species and the instinctual desire of all species to perpetuate their existence is not to perpetuate a mindless fact. It's to perpetuate consciousness of that existence, then the enjoyment of that consciousness. Consciousness with enjoyment. And so, even with that very small germ of reaction, you find at the heart of all things this reaching out toward that which will give it more of consciousness and joy and energy and love. With that, gradually then, you find this energy pulling it. With the outward movements of the planets, the outward influence of the galaxy, all these things tend to gradually magnetize life in an automatic way, so that without any conscious knowledge of what it's doing, life evolves. And the soul evolves. It's said in the Indian scriptures it takes 5 to 8 million incarnations to reach the human level. That's a long time. It's only the beginning. It would seem like once you've reached the human level, then you can go like lightning. But the trouble is that once man has developed intelligence, he's able to use that intelligence to get confused, to reach out toward all sorts of things that have nothing to do with his own progress. Man reaches out toward involvement and uses his intelligence for sheer craft. And so he thinks in terms of self-aggrandizement and power and competition and destruction and so on. Well, always the process is toward more and more energy. Even on the human level, we find that as man does those things which give him more energy, with that energy, it may be that he did something that was not in itself spiritual. For example, a person might, after being lazy and purely self-indulgent, decide to be a thief. And by being a thief, he doesn't seem like he's getting good karma. Of course, he isn't getting good karma, but he's doing something preferable to being lazy. Because what he's doing in the process of using his intelligence is exerting energy. And as he exerts that energy, he begins to become more aware, even if his awareness is only how to rob more people. With that gradual opening of awareness, of understanding, comes slowly the understanding that that isn't what is in his own highest interest. Anything that you can do that will help to generate a greater flow of energy will be, to some extent at least, helpful. But there are those things, of course, which will help you to develop energy in a straight line, and those which will help you to develop energy into a dead-end street, and you'll have to come back and try all over again. A person with great enthusiasm takes to drinking, but at the end of that road is less consciousness, not more. People, I've seen this, I just was in Mexico for a few days getting a little rest to my brain, and one thing I've observed in Mexico is that North Americans who go there, Americans who move there, tend to settle into a life of excessive drinking. They aren't able to handle the lower level of energy. They're so used to being hyperactive in this country that they disintegrate when they go down to a place where the people there may or may not be energetic, I can't say, but at least they're certainly energetic in a different way. It may take energy to know how to do nothing, for example. But if it does, I have to say that we don't know how to do it. And so, the average American who moves there, he'll be thinking with great energy of, oh, what a lovely, peaceful life, I can go and drink with my friends, and we can go fishing and so on. But they end up drinking before breakfast and staying drunk all day, and it becomes a real problem. I mentioned this to somebody there, and she said, wow, you know, you're right. She's been living there several years, and I think I made her think. I didn't mean to say anything personally, but it became quite obvious the moment she reacted that she was taking it very personally and that that was her problem. But again, that looks like a road that's going to give them a new kind of energy, and it does give them a new kind of energy for a while. The typical American who moves to Mexico for the first year or two will be writing back his friend saying, boy, this is the life. But then after a while, what happens? You see, there are so many dead ends. A person who's going to be out robbing people, bit by bit, he begins to worry about them robbing him. And so he starts building all these defenses, and in these defenses he starts closing himself in. And he becomes suspicious and hostile and all those things that close his mind off, closes his heart off, and as a result he's less conscious, less energetic than before. So these things that start out that way don't finish that way until we can learn the true direction. An interesting aspect, too, to what Sri Yukteswar was speaking about, the unfolding, the opening of the intelligence so that the heart can evolve. People in the beginning, they use their brains all the time. They think their way to solutions. They think how to get ahead of the pack and so on. Then bit by bit they realize that the answer doesn't lie in thinking. The answer lies in feeling more. That's why women tend to be more religious and more spiritually minded than men, because they more naturally understand and react to the flow of the heart, the love of the heart. And if men can do that too and not rely too heavily on reason, and that doesn't mean not to reason, it means not to think that all your answers will come that way. The answers really need to be in a balance between the two. All of these things, it isn't as if you shed one, it's that you add a new dimension to that which exists. You still act, you still perceive through the senses, you still intuit, and I mean, you still think, but you have to learn to intuit. You have to learn to use the heart wisely. So now, what happens as an obstruction to this awakening is what Sri Yukteswar called the meannesses of the heart. The meannesses of the heart are those things which make us want the narrow as opposed to the broad view of things. We want that which is our own. We want to think in terms of our own pride, our own position, our own prestige. And the heart becomes enclosed in itself and ceases to, or never learns how to relate to other people, how to feel their sufferings as one's own, how to feel their joys as one's own, and enter into the consciousness of the universe around us, which is only a tiny part of which is manifested as our little egos. We are that. We aren't just this. The reality of our own being is only the tip of it is this ego. And behind that is the whole ocean of divine awareness. Now, the path to this enlightenment has a physical counterpart, and that is the just as we have the pole, the positive and negative poles, it's like a bar magnet. The positive pole, the north pole, the negative pole, the south, we are all built on that same simple principle of the bar magnet. The positive pole is the head, the negative pole is the base of the spine. And the spine itself is that magnetic field through which, that magnetic passage through which the energy has to pass, and all of it becomes centered up here in the brain before a person can achieve spiritual enlightenment. There are mechanical aspects to the path. As long as we're living in a physical body, as long as these outward specific things happen, we can learn to manipulate them in such a way as to bring about more rapid spiritual progress. It's not all just a matter of thinking love, love. It's a matter of realizing the chance that love and that loving energy pass in order to achieve their own natural goals. Where there is love, there's a direction of energy. And usually that direction of love and energy flows out toward things and people and possessions. If we can learn to bring that energy inward and upward and direct it toward the brain, then we will be able to achieve the final state of enlightenment. In the beginning, and this is again something that doesn't happen as easily. On the lower levels of life, there's a little bit of attraction. The attraction of a plant for music, the attraction of plants for one another, the sexual attraction of different animals, the loyalty that some animals feel as they evolve. A friend of mine in Romania was coming out of her house. She had a German shepherd. There was a mad dog running loose. She didn't know about it. And this mad dog came running up the path toward her to bite her. And the German shepherd, out of sheer loyalty to her, knowing what this dog was, knowing there was nothing it could do to fight the dog off because it was mad, went and stood in front of her so the dog would bite it. And the shepherd died. They didn't have a means of curing it. But that kind of loyalty is certainly not mechanical. You find noble instincts expressed in the animals. Not as much so as in man, but God is in everything, and some bit of God will manifest even in the lowest forms of life. But gradually, as this evolves more and more, we find ourselves attracted to people. We're attracted to them because of a sense of kinship with them. We're dimly aware that we are a part of them and they a part of us. The kinship that we feel may be first that they're our own family or our own nation, or that we're in love with them, or that this is a friend and we like to drink together or play football together or whatever it might be. In the beginning there is that. Bit by bit we begin to be aware of a kinship on a higher level, and we start seeking out spiritual relationships. And finally we're attracted to one who for us manifests more than any other the divine qualities that we are trying to reach, to which we aspire. And we accept such a person as our guru. This person is still only an image in the deepest sense. God is the final guru. But this person, more than all whom we have met, is that who magnetizes us in our own deepest nature and helps us to understand that we are a part of the infinite flow. And so through that guru, we gradually are able to pass through the gateway of human consciousness into the divine consciousness, and to realize that the life that is in us is the life that is in everything. We need to direct this energy that is in us always in that way that will speed us toward what we really want, because everything else in the end turns out to be not only necessarily a dead end in itself, but it can and often is a pull in the opposite direction. It's very interesting, the animals, they have tails. It's the energy going more still down toward the negative side. Man no longer has a tail. The breasts of a woman are not down in the stomach as an animal's is. They're up here, where the heart is. There's more of that upward feeling in man. He walks upright. Everything in his bearing, in his consciousness, aspires toward a higher awareness. Man tends to think more here at the point between the eyebrows and not at the base of his spine, although when you watch people dancing nowadays, you wonder. In fact, modern dancing is to a very large extent a subconscious impulse justified by a lot of modern psychology that tries to tell us that we are basically only animals. Science gives us this dogma that we are only animals. Religion reinforces it by saying we're only sinners. And so there is this downward pull that takes us actually away from what we really want to be. Says that, well, if you want to be real, you got to be gutsy. You got to be, you know, an animal. If you know what you want, you know that what you're looking for is joy. If you know what you want, you know that it has to be related to love and peace and expansion. This is what all beings basically long for. And that tunnel of the spine, that energy, spells the entire distance between man, or the rocks even, and the infinite. It's a tunnel to eternity. In the science of yoga, it talks also about the different chakras in the spine and the fact that each of these chakras contains a certain aspect of this downward pull. They call them elements, but it doesn't mean elements in the chemical sense. It's elements in another use of the word, and in fact a more justifiable use, because chemistry came along and took over the word elements very late in the game. But for a long time people were talking about elements in this sense. They spoke of air, fire, water, earth, didn't they? And now, of course, they say, oh, this was an old superstition. It sounds like it, because they don't understand what it meant. But the truth is that these are the different stages of manifestation from spirit into matter. First there was consciousness, then energy, then the gaseous substances of the universe, and then those coalesced and they became fire, the stars, everything in conflagration. And then gradually, as those cooled, they became molten, and there was the flowing rocks, and then those coalesced, those froze, cooled down, and became solid. And you have these different stages of outward manifestation from spirit into matter, all of which has to be retraced back into spirit before we can reclaim oneness with God. The stages of outward manifestation represent also, as I was saying earlier, the different stages of psychological, spiritual involvement in matter. And the chakras in the spine represent also these different stages of involvement. So that the lowest chakra, at the base of the spine, which is the farthest away from the north pole, the positive pole, the farthest toward the tamoguna or tamasic darkening quality, is the earth element. This earth element is that which we have to evolve even as human beings. Life evolves gradually. In the beginning there's no vertebra even, but as the vertebra develops, it gradually evolves up the spine toward the brain and out through the spiritual eye. And we, just as the embryo in the womb goes through the different stages of evolution until it takes on the human shape. If you see the embryo, the fetus, at different stages of its development, it looks like different lower animals. So also, we have within our own bodies at this time the whole story of our spiritual evolution. Everything that we are is a manifestation of what we have been and what the world has been. Master pointed out, even I remember in a lecture of his, showing how the ear is patterned after the shell in the sea. The very constitution of the blood, the salt, the proportion of salt to liquid water is the same as in the sea. The salt, the proportion of salt in the water of the sea. And so, in all ways, we're a part of this great drama and of creation. And as our energy evolves and comes up the spine, what we do is have to reawaken on a subtler and more meaningful level our grasp of these different stages that we've come through in the past, but evolve them more completely. That's why it said, in the opening of the chakras, as the kundalini energy rises up the spine, the yogi develops power over these different levels, power over matter, power over liquids, the ability to walk on water, etc. Develops certain what seem to be miraculous powers just because he has completely withdrawn his energy from that lower level of manifestation and therefore has become its master. Well, we need also, in a more obvious sense, to draw the energy away from identification with solid matter, to realize that this whole world is really just a dream, that it hasn't any reality, that it's just sort of a veil over what really is, that matter is only there to sort of obscure the blazing light and energy that shines at the heart of every atom. And as we are able to withdraw our attachment even, and this is something that, this is why all spiritual practices form a part of this total picture. What are you taught in religion? You're taught to not be attached to this world. Realize that it's God's world. Don't think of things as important. Realize that you're here only for a short time, that it's all a dream, that your reality needs to be drawn back from this and let life go on as it will, but don't think of it as your permanent home. Learn to love God. Learn to love people. All of these have their counterpart in what happens inwardly as you practice Kriya Yoga and the science of yoga. The energy withdraws from that lowest chakra. That lowest chakra becomes awakened, and you begin to realize that matter, solid matter, isn't you. And then also, as that, it's interesting how it affects you on all levels. For example, when you develop that lowest chakra, you're also developing the firmness that matter can give you. The positive side, the negative side of matter is its inertia. The positive side of it is its strength. And you get into the positive side when that energy flow starts to move upward toward the positive pole, away from the negative pole of nescience, of unknowing. And with that, you develop also the positive qualities of the earth element, that firmness of purpose, steadfastness, the rock-firm stance of meditation, where you don't allow anything to sway you. You just keep your mind firmly on God.